Can I make a suggestion? Radio.
The hell did you just say to me?
This is the Extra Hawk Ride Podcast, episode 386 for the week of December 20th, 2021. I am Rapid Chocolate Eater David T. Cole, and I'm here with Table Read Boozer Sarah D. Bunting.
It's 10:15 somewhere.
Giver of a female perspective from another generation, Tara Ariano.
Actually.
And walker and talker, Tim Grierson.
I just hope this hallway is long enough for all the quips I have to deliver.
Welcome to Extra Hot Great for another week, our last regular episode of 2021. And joining us for this very special episode, he's a film critic you've read at Mel Magazine and Screen Daily. You've heard him on the Grierson and Leach podcast. It's Tim Grierson!
Tim!
Welcome, Tim! Yay!
I'm the Christmas treat. This is very nice. Thank you for having me.
Mm-hmm. We are here to talk about Being the Ricardos. It's 1952, and married stars/producers Lucille Ball, Nicole Kidman, and Desi Arnaz, Javier Bardem, are in the second season of their sitcom, I Love Lucy, going into production on an episode in which Fred, William Frawley, played by J.K. Simmons, and Ethel, Vivian Vance, played by Nina Arianda, have a big fight. But three events are converging to make this work week exceptionally difficult. Walter Winchell has reported that Lucy is a registered communist. A tabloid has just run a story about Desi cheating on Lucy. And Lucy is pregnant and wants to write it into the show as a storyline for her character, Lucy Ricardo. How will everyone get through it? The film has been out in select theaters for a few weeks. It just dropped on Amazon Prime Video December 21st. Let's do the Chen check-in, quickly go around the circle, and answer the question, should our listeners watch Being the Ricardos, Tim?
No.
Sarah.
Well, actually, no.
Dave?
There are three Sorkins. Good Sorkin, like the West Wing. There is good, bad Sorkin, like the Newsroom. And there's bad Sorkin, which is Being the Ricardos. So, no.
Yeah. I am a Sorkin hate completist, so I would watch, will watch anything he does. If there were 10 more, 50 more seasons of the Newsroom, I would have watched them. So if you're a psycho like me, you're going to watch it regardless. But anyone else who's not a psycho like me should not. So we're all in agreement. But let's talk about it anyway and explain why. So Tim, Aaron Sorkin, who wrote and directed this, somewhat famously told Lacey Rose at The Hollywood Reporter that he doesn't think I Love Lucy is funny. Would you say that's the main reason he is wrong to tell this story?
I don't think that's actually the main reason. Okay. I will say that, you know, I was very emphatic in my no earlier. I don't hate the movie. I just don't think it works. Mm-hmm. For me, the bigger problem, kind of to Dave's point, there's a Sorkin that I can kind of appreciate. I'm not a Sorkin hater. Mm-hmm. I'm somebody who actually feels like, yeah, as long as you don't take his stuff seriously, if you don't take him as seriously as he takes himself,
yes,
his stuff can be really entertaining. And yeah. For me, the Newsroom was like, this show is dumb, but it's entertaining in a way that I can kind of keep watching it from week to week. And so,
yeah.
So like, as long as I don't believe anything that anybody is talking about, I can enjoy that fine. And for me, Being the Ricardos is kind of the same way, where it's like, okay, when this movie is not about anything other than we got to put on a TV show by Friday, that's perfectly entertaining. That is actually kind of fun to watch. You know, it's him doing his quips. He kind of creates that world that he always does, where like you see how the power systems work on the I Love Lucy TV show. That stuff's kind of fun. When the movie pauses and says, but really, this movie is about the wave of communism in America, or the state of journalism, or about how, you know, marriage, how it works for a working couple and how the challenges are.
Yep.
That's when you think, oh, like, this is a problem, and I actually don't care what you're saying at all, Aaron Sorkin. Like, there is a moment in the movie, I want to be kind of careful of spoilers, but there's a moment in the movie where Lucy stops talking and reflects and basically says something about the space where they film the show and it being the place where she can basically, like, fly free, whatever it is that she says. And I think to myself, Lucille Ball never said that. Aaron Sorkin is making this up to explain the character. That's the stuff where, for me, I just think, I don't need Aaron Sorkin to explain this stuff to me.
Yeah.
Mm.
There is a certain now you're on the trolley energy to half of this movie that was fine. Like, I did enjoy the nuts and bolts of breaking down a TV show over a week. Mm-hmm. But when they got off the trolley, it was just like, you know, you check in your watch. It's like, I hate Lucy now.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and I mean, having had to teach to college students the actual episode in which they do, it's called Lucy is Enceinte, and because they couldn't use the word pregnant, and like I had to teach this to college students and be like, this is why this is important historiographically in TV history. And like, I sort of agree with Sorkin that the show is not necessarily funny, although it can be instructive. The problem is that when Sorkin is trying to be instructive, that's all you feel, like Tim said. This reminded me of A Few Good Men. People who are in this situation don't talk like this. There are a bunch of anachronisms. There's absolutely no way that like a JAG lawyer would be talking like an Aaron Sorkin character. And also that all the Aaron Sorkin characters are obvious Aaron Sorkin characters that were popped off a central plastic tree, like the little pegs in the Game of Life. But that can be, as we've said, not soothing exactly, but if you just sort of don't take it seriously, it's fine. But then when these little plastic pieces are pedi-conferencing somewhere and telling you some larger thing about women in writers' rooms, like coming from that fucking guy who can't write a female character, like this is where it sort of loses me as something beyond something to look at and sort of watching certain National Treasure actors work. That like that's where it sort of loses me as like a sort of larger instructive prospect. But just to look at the production design, wonderful. To wool gather about what this would have been if it had been being the Mertzes and someone else wrote it, who has a slightly better ear for making different characters speak differently to one another. Sure. Like, I wasn't offended by it or angry that I spent the time. I watched it at one time speed, but, you know, it's just not, it's not essential. And I think if you really need to care what Aaron Sorkin thinks about the bigger issues facing mid-century woman-led televised entertainment, then you will respond to this in a different way to how we do.
Well, from a filmic perspective, let's take it back to Tim, because there are sort of there was a sort of format for biopics for a long time where it was like the whole span of a life. And now there's sort of a vogue of where it's just a slice of life. Like My Week with Marilyn is another example. Do you think that this is successful on that level, like from a construction perspective, or did it work on that level for you?
I would say in general, I tend to prefer the Lincoln's got to pass an amendment biopic as opposed to let's see the whole life.
Mm. Yeah.
I do like that kind of more specific biopic. And obviously, like, he's acknowledged and 10,000 articles have mentioned the three things that they are wrestling with did not happen at the same time.
No.
He put those together. And that doesn't bother me. Like, I'm not somebody like, how dare he change facts like that? I don't care about that. For me, there's enough, you know, to Dave's point. I actually think the movie has a decent amount of energy because there's just always so much stuff happening in the film. And I think that, you know, it's a biopic about two people. It's more about Lucille Ball, obviously, but there's also a decent amount about Desi Arnaz as well. And before the movie came out, there's a lot of conversation about, oh, well, Nicole Kidman looks nothing like Lucille Ball, and how is she going to pull this off? I actually found that Nicole Kidman did not bother me.
Me neither.
In terms of how she plays her, I think she gets basically the voice essentially right, and that's kind of all I need. I'm a Nicole Kidman fan, so I tend to like her in just about everything that she does, and I especially like it when she plays these types of, as Aaron Sorkin writes her, take charge characters, and I think Nicole Kidman can do that really well. In terms of its biopic-y quality, that I think the structure works. I mean, basically, it is a very Aaron Sorkin structure. Mm-hmm. It's not told in a linear fashion.
Right.
It's, here's the stuff that's happening. Oh, but here are some flashbacks. And those flashbacks for reasons that make no sense, are narrated by the writers in the present day as if we're watching Reds.
Right.
And they're talking about the past. Yeah. I have watched this movie twice now. I had to see it a few weeks ago, and then I rewatched it for us to talk about it. And both times I'm like, I'm not being glib. I genuinely do not understand what the point of the modern day perspective is on this. And so it's like, which what Sorkin does, and especially like with like Social Network, he did this where it's like, it's not just a linear story. It's told in this kind of like jigsaw puzzle kind of way. Mm-hmm. And on a very superficial level, I enjoy that because like, oh, we're bouncing around from here to there and here to there. The biopic problem comes in when it's like, it's going to explain Lucille Ball. It's going to explain their relationship and the big sort of reveal at the very end of dun, 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 big spoiler. All of that stuff where we're supposed to like understand that Sorkin knows these characters and knows these people and has like kind of cracked the code on them.
Yeah.
That's where the biopic stuff just doesn't work in the movie.
Yeah.
And it manages, despite using all these filmic things that you couldn't do on a stage, to be really stagey.
Mm-hmm.
Like I sometimes think that the only reason that he moved away from that as his preferred medium is that he then could do flashbacks a lot more easily without having to have like stage elements and production elements like on the set of like dolly tracking in and out. I am told that his To Kill a Mockingbird was, despite being literally stagey, like just as bad in all of these elements, perhaps because there were newsroom people in it. Like, I don't know, but I didn't see it. My husband is still bitching about it. It was like 2 years ago. But yeah, I mean, I think he wants to think that he has traditions down and then can send them up in some way or like invert them. And I think he's not quite as good and serious as he thinks he is. And if this guy doesn't stop having a stiffy for explaining comedy process to the American people, I don't know what. Stop.
Sarah, if he doesn't explain it to us, who's going to?
Well,
I mean, I walk around on a daily basis.
It's me and Tara. He's got to fucking explain it to
you. I do kind of love to jump in really fast. One of the things that drives me crazy in a movie like this, and I don't think it's done well in this movie, is I'm Lucille Ball. Hold on a second. My comedy spidey sense is tingling.
Yeah.
I know how to fix this thing. And the way it's done, I mean, obviously that's Sorkin's way of saying, look what a genius she was, how she could kind of come up with stuff on the fly. But it's done in such a hackneyed, like, cliched way that it's just kind of like, oh, good job, Lucille Ball. You were smart and came up with some ideas. As a friend of mine, as a colleague said, her big revelation on the show is turn the actors around so they can face the camera.
Yes! There's no way that director wouldn't have done that. Thank you for bringing
that how bad
up.
That guy is. God. He would come up with that eventually. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a three-camera setup. Like, there's no way they would be sitting with their backs to the audience to begin with. I'm so stupid. Thank you very much. But in terms of the framing device with the writers, which, like, you say the present day, but it can't possibly be the present day because all of those writers would be dead now. Like, if they were adults in the 50s, they are not Linda Lavin now. You know what I mean?
Yeah, like, the framing device is, like, the 80s or something.
Right.
Yeah, anyway.
And I guess they don't really their clothes are very generic. Like, they don't really say what year it's supposed to be. Mm. But if you're going to do that, I feel like that gives you the chance to give it to that sort of, like, a documentary-ish patina that then you don't have to also have the scenes where like eight guys are sitting in Desi's office and they go around saying all their names and their jobs, which like everyone in this room knows who they are. That would never happen. It's just like, we know you read research. Congratulations. You don't have to put it all on the script page.
Yeah. And then you told the Hollywood Reporter that you thought all the books you read for your research were bad. You seem really fun, Aaron Sorkin. Please come over.
I mean, in terms of biopic conventions, of course, it's always the thing from Walk Hard. But don't you agree, John Lennon from the Beatles? In that moment.
Yes.
Yeah. That moment in the movie, I did kind of like because it's so blatant. There's always part of me that wonder if Sorkin was actually like sending up that convention.
Right.
He rarely seems sly in terms of his humor. So I don't give him credit for that. But I did love that. Maybe that's what it was, a convention in the 1950s. You had to go around legally and give your name and your occupation when you were in a boardroom meeting. Perhaps that's what you had to do back then.
I guess, but then pretend that they already did it and just put chyrons. Like, if you know what I mean? Like, there's ways around this stuff. Also, when it got to the end and we saw the Arnaz kids were executive producers, I was like, because the last time this happened was when we were watching the documentary last year on Showtime about the Comedy Store, which seemed like it also elided a lot of details. It's just like, as soon as I saw their names were on it, made me wonder, what is the actual story about her communism in the historical record? Because I just don't trust the Sorkin version.
Yeah, it's interesting because I read that one, I guess it was Slate, right? Slate had a piece about how, and apparently there isn't much to it. That apparently what appears in the movie is kind of the nuts and bolts of, like, there's not like a, Sorkin isn't hiding anything in it. For me, what I just found kind of interesting is that, like you said, they don't actually say what time period it is at any point. Right. And this seems like the type of movie where it would say, like, they say Monday and Tuesday and Wednesday and Thursday and Friday to orient you in the week. But I kind of expected this would be the type of movie where some character would say, like, Charlie, come on, it's 1952.
Yeah.
Right?
To talk about how modern something is. Like, come on, we're in the Dark Ages. It's 1953. And nobody actually does that. So I guess,
little,
you know, hat tip to Sorkin.
There wasn't a Philo Farnsworth reference, frankly. Maybe there was, and I didn't hear it.
What about the technical aspects of directing? Let's turn it to Tim. How does he do?
So this is his third film as a director. He did Molly's Game, which, for the record, I liked for the exact same reasons I said earlier. As long as you don't take that movie seriously, it's just kind of fun. It's like,
sure.
And Jessica Chastain, like, I'm wearing low-cut dresses and talking tough. That's fine.
Yeah. No, that was, having read the book, it was, superior product to the text.
Yeah. That's enough of a motion picture for me. That's fine.
Low bar, but still.
Yeah. And then he did Trial of Chicago 7, which was fine and benefited from the fact that the true story is really interesting. But that was also a movie where it's like, stop, everybody. I've got to tell you important things.
Yeah. Yes.
You are not aware of. About America. But I actually thought it was pretty well acted and people chewed the scenery nicely. And this is his third film as a director. And I think this is his worst film as a filmmaker. I think that he can, I mean, Sarah talked about it being stagey. And it is pretty stagey. It has that quality that Sorkin's work often has. I feel like where it is dialogue first, like actually framing of scenes and framing of shots and putting together like scenes. Like, there's so much in the movie about blocking. This whole idea is that they have to deal with the blocking in I Love Lucy, and the blocking's not working. And Lucy is fighting with the director about it. What is funny about Sorkin as a director is I would not exactly say that his blocking is that inspired. Now, it doesn't have to be like, not every movie has to be like a Scorsese film in terms of like the camera, you really kind of notice it. But it is a movie that, it's now on Amazon. It was in theaters, like you said earlier. You can watch this on TV just fine. I don't think the theatrical experience is going to make it. And to be honest, I actually think it looks kind of low budget in terms of some of the production design and set design. And so there's a little part of me that thinks I think TV will help people's experience of watching this movie. I think that technically he is a perfectly proficient filmmaker, but in some ways the problem is more he kind of needs somebody else. Like, what's the best Sorkin film? The best Sorkin films are
Malice.
Okay, I'll accept Malice. I was gonna say A Few Good Men
and
Social Network, and that's because other filmmakers, but the point still remains, somebody else directed those scripts.
Right? Yeah.
And in some ways he kind of needs somebody to go, okay, this is 85% great. The 15% that is so you, Sorkin, we're going to take that out and do something with.
Yeah.
When it's pure uncut Sorkin, it's more like you can't escape. It's like it's pure uncut Sorkin.
Yeah. And then there are a couple of places, and I don't always tend to notice this stuff as much as I should, frankly. But there were a couple of spots here where I made a note that was like, that's a really weird place to go to the other side of the two shot. And it's because I think he may not be aware that he's betraying this, but like there's one scene where they switch, like it should be a big moment for Desi. It's like this climactic moment in their relationship. And the shot switches to look at Lucy. And it's like, he wants to see the effect of his dialogue on the character. He doesn't want to see the actor doing it. He wants to see the actor feeling it. And it's like, you're already Aaron Sorkin.
Yeah.
President of the Aaron Sorkin Club. What, like, really? Do we have to watch that? Like, but I don't feel like we have to watch that. But it's, he does make certain choices that are like a little bit strokey. And I'll leave it at that.
We'll put this with the last shot in the movie. I won't spoil it because it's such a humdinger of a shot. But it's such a, it's the most showy shot in the movie. And clearly it's supposed to be like, aha. And it's like a camera move, essentially. And it's like, what is this actually doing in this moment?
Yeah.
Like on a, you know, if you go to film school, they will say, if cameras are going to move and things are going to happen, you have to justify why they happen story-wise.
Right.
I would say it's actually basically for him to go, ta-da, at the end of his movie.
I could tell my AD to set up the shot. Yeah, probably.
Yeah. Well, being the Ricardos is a land of contrast, it sounds like.
Can we talk about the title for a second?
Sure.
It's bad, right?
Yes.
Like it's the type of title that I actually thought, oh, this must be the title that the book was adapted from, right? Mm-hmm. No. Mm-hmm. And this movie took years to develop. This is the title they came up with?
Yeah. When they were talking about it on Who Weekly a couple of weeks ago, they kept saying Meet the Ricardos. It's like, even that is better.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Goodwill Ricardos? I don't even, yeah, I don't know.
We're the Ricardos? You could do that.
A Few Good Ricardos. We could go on, but shouldn't.
It is time to go around the dial talking about something we're watching on TV recently. Does not necessarily have to be something new, but let's see what Tara has.
Well, in keeping with our TV to movie lead topic, I have two shows adapted from two movies for my last Around the Dial of the year, starting with Finding Magic Mike. Now, Magic Mike is the movie series about male exotic dancers that we all love to know. A third installment was just announced, bringing back original director Steven Soderbergh to the franchise. But in the meantime, we have this reality show on HBO Max. So after the success of the movie, obviously a live stage show followed. There's a residency in Las Vegas. There are also touring companies. So this is a reality show about discovering a new dancer to join an ensemble. They then get a job plus $100,000. And then the first episode, 50 guys audition. They get winnowed down to 25, then to the 10 that we'll be following through the season. Adam Rodriguez from the movies is the host. We also meet Allison Falk, the choreographer and a producer for the live shows, whose name I didn't catch. He's the most boring one. Don't worry about it. There's another guy. Naturally, a lot of these dudes are conventionally muscly. They have the confidence that comes with that, but not all of them. One guy admits he doesn't feel comfortable in his body, which is kind of a thick dad bod type. One wishes he were more sexually assertive with his girlfriend. Another is a bisexual ex-Mormon stretching further away from his upbringing by doing this. You've seen a reality show before. You know the ones with the best stories are going to get picked for the season. Predictability aside, it is surprisingly sweet. The cameras catch the guys in conversation with each other being kind of vulnerable in a way that you don't see from primarily straight guys. And as they go through the process, all of the judges have to try to get them to understand how important it is for them to be attentive to the primarily straight women who are going to be in their audiences, particularly in a lap dance audition where a bunch of women volunteer and then give feedback afterwards, which is my favorite scene. This is not sex work exactly, but it is sex work adjacent. And thus, it reminds me of the old Showtime show Gigolos. Anyone? Just me? Fine. And an absolutely fascinating Japanese documentary film called The Great Happiness Space, which is about male escorts at what are called host bars in Osaka, where they work with female clients. So men who are going to be good at this job are the ones who are at home in the female gaze, and that is very clear in the first episode. Also, like all the HBO Max reality shows I've watched, and I've watched a bunch, it looks so expensive. Even F-Boy Island, yes, and the terrible Bethany Frankel show that I loved look so much more polished than their subject matter deserves. And since this one needs to showcase the dancing in a way that allows a viewer to assess it, it is shot with as much care as Legendary, the ballroom drag ball show. It looks great. And it's fun. It's probably not safe for your whole family to watch together over the holidays. But it's not like guys are hanging dong. If you think someone can handle seeing butt cheeks jiggle, go for it. And it's really more wholesome than you might think. It's really positive about its participants. All episodes are up now on HBO
hanging
Max.
Dong.
Guys hanging dong.
Well, Merry Christmas to us all.
This is what people want to know. So I'm getting
guys hanging dong on the Christmas tree. Happy holidays, everybody.
It's a Christmas holiday.
We also watched MacGruber, which is based on the 2008 movie, which was based on a series of SNL sketches that were based on MacGyver. Dave and I tried to rewatch the movie not very long ago. It's definitely from the era when the Lonely Island guys had not totally cracked long-form storytelling. See also Hot Rod. There are cute bits, but it's very flabby. There's also a lot of edgelordy gags that have not aged well, like so much that I was, after 15 minutes, I was like, I think I'm good on this. But the show is very funny. After the events of the first movie are retold in song by MacGruber's dead wife, played by Maya Rudolph, we get into the story. MacGruber is incarcerated for things he did in the movie. But then General Barrett Fasus, Lawrence Fishburne, doing this and not the new Matrix movie, and why not? He shows up with a job for him. A high-value target has been kidnapped, and the captors have specifically requested to swap her with MacGruber. Who is the baddie? Will MacGruber rise to the occasion? And what's happening with his loved ones, Vicky St. Elmo and Dixon Piper? Also co-stars Sam Elliott, Sarah, and Billy Zane, Dave. I'm telling Dave like he didn't watch it. He did. If you enjoy spoofs like Children's Hospital or Angie Tribeca, or last year's Medical Police, this is very much in that mode of stupidity. The season is only 8 very silly episodes. They make an excellent addition to the suite of original comedy series on Peacock. Dave, anything to add? Ray MacGruber.
Yeah, I disagree with you. I thought it was like 2 pounds of show in a 10-pound bag. There was like one or two good jokes per episode. And then the rest of the show, they were trying to do like 3 different things 10 minutes at a time. It was like, okay, Here's an action show and we're going to do this set piece and it's not funny. And then we're going to do a couple jokes and it's the same fucking joke over and over again. I wouldn't recommend it.
I didn't realize I was making you watch it.
You were. Now you know.
Wow. Well.
So for your recent Sam Elliott needs, MacGruber, Yellowstone, Kara.
Last season of Justified, even though he doesn't have a mustache. I know. For my plug, Gloria Calderon-Kellett, who created the One Day at a Time reboot, has a new show on Amazon called With Love, and I interviewed her about it. That is at Decider, and we will link it in the show notes.
Tim, what do you got?
So I have 2 things. Not much dong in neither of them. I was struck by the fact that Tara and Dave had their own Desi Lucille situation that just happened right there, where it's like careers and professional and personal life. How is it all going to work together? I needed someone to explain to me, though, how a podcast worked. I was hoping Sorkin could come in and help us with that part.
Oh, you should watch And Just Like That on HBO Max.
So I have 2 things I've been watching recently, kind of catching up on. The first is Insecure, which is finishing its final season. And the final episode is going to air on December 26th. And I'm caught up to this point. I have been sent the final episode, but I haven't watched it yet because I kind of want to save it. When the pandemic started, there were like, there's just nothing on television now. Let's catch up on certain shows that we've always wanted to see. And Insecure was one of those shows I'd always heard great things about. And I love the show kind of from its first episode, but what was especially poignant, I live in Los Angeles, is that we couldn't go anywhere in kind of the first months of the pandemic. And for people who have seen Insecure, you know that it's set in Los Angeles, mostly in South LA, which is not far away from where I live. And so seeing all those just glorious overhead shots of Los Angeles and all these great restaurants and the characters being in these different worlds made me so nostalgic. And I actually told my wife, Susan, who watched it with me, it's like, I feel like I'm seeing the Los Angeles I don't get to see anymore because we can't leave our houses. And so there's a real poignance when I first started watching the show. But I also just really came to love those characters. You know, it's co-created by Issa Rae, and she's the main character in it. But she and her friend Molly, I think in terms of just like television friendships, television relationships, I really kind of came to care about both of them. And I really loved how both of them were different types of people, but were not so diametrically opposed. We're like, she's like this, but she's like that. They actually, it was enough nuance between those two characters. And the relationship developed as the show went along. Their friends, Issa's boyfriends, in season 5, which has basically happened for people who are not keeping up, is Lawrence, the guy that she probably really loves, and the guy that she dumped in season 1 because he was basically kind of being a layabout and kind of was unmotivated and lazy, has turned his life around And for a while, it seemed like maybe they were going to end up together. He'd had a previous relationship, got his girlfriend pregnant. Lawrence is now raising this child with this woman that he doesn't even really kind of love. Meanwhile, Issa has been pursued by this guy, Nathan, who's a barber in her neighborhood, who has these like mental health issues that he's struggling with. And one of the things in terms of like series ago, multiple seasons, because my day job is watching movies and reviewing movies, one of the things I love about movies is that they're 2 hours, maybe 2.5 hours, and then they're basically done. And TV shows have a different type of commitment. And I tend not to be somebody who likes a really sort of soapy or melodramatic series. But Insecure is like the one exception for me, because while the show has gotten soapier in its later seasons, I have really just kind of come to care so much about those people, so much so that when I started watching season five, I almost just didn't realize how much I had missed these people. I think the first three seasons are basically perfect. I think season four got a little rockier. My feeling about season five is that I think a lot is going to depend on how it lands in its final episode. That's why I didn't want to watch it before we all talked about it.
Yeah.
But for me, like that episode, so the sort of standalone episode about Lawrence going back and forth between the Bay Area and Los Angeles and how he kind of wrestles with that, I thought was really beautifully written and really beautifully acted. I think that that cast kind of top to bottom is pretty great. It will not end probably as strongly as it started, but I have to say, as a straight white guy, watching a show about Black life in Los Angeles and about like women's lives in Los Angeles was not just really funny and really poignant and really well written. It was so eye-opening. Like I said, I don't live that far away from where Issa and her friends live on the show. And to me, watching it definitely like during kind of the rise of Black Lives Matter last summer, I thought a lot about what that show had to say, not just about race, but sort of like some of the things that Issa deals with and some of the stuff that Molly deals with, like becoming successful in their professions. Do they feel like they are somehow compromising who they are as Black women? And that's something I never have to think about in my life. And I think that the show did it in such a beautiful way, such a nuanced way. The exact opposite of what we talked about in terms of Sorkin. Like the nuance, the sensitivity, the thoughtfulness in terms of what the show communicates. And also the fact that the show is very, very funny. It's really, really a funny show. That's one of the two things. But I'm going to miss it when it's gone.
Me too.
And then the second thing is How To with John Wilson, also on HBO. And I've seen every episode that's aired so far. And I think at this point, probably most people know the conceit of How To with John Wilson. John Wilson's a documentary filmmaker in New York. Each episode is him giving advice and guidance on something fairly benign. And then the show kind of dovetails and explores and kind of goes from there. And a lot of it, the humor comes from all of this random footage that he's gotten of random things in New York. They're counterbalanced with his very awkward way of doing his narration, which I have found really charming kind of from the first episode. Like I said, my day job is being a film critic. And I especially like there's been this sort of this new wave of recent documentary filmmakers who are sort of exploring what a documentary can be. And one of my favorite film festivals in America is this festival called True False, which is a documentary festival in Missouri where they show all different types of nonfiction work. And they actually showed the Nathan For You feature length episode at the festival and had Nathan Fielder come and talk. And Nathan Fielder is obviously a producer on How To with John Wilson as well. But I just really like I like Nathan For You, but there's something about How To with John Wilson that I think I prefer even more, because there is such a, even if it's entirely manufactured, and I don't think it is, there is such a sincerity in terms of what John Wilson is doing and the sincerity that he gets from the people that he talks to. He never makes you feel like he's making fun of those people. And some of those people deserve to be mocked, but he doesn't kind of lean into that. He kind of has faith that you're going to kind of figure it out, but also kind of go, like again and again, I'm just so impressed with his ability to get people to open up to him. And there's such a trust there. I mean, obviously everybody loves his landlady. And that was a big thing going into season two. Like, how is she doing? What's going on with her? And he kept saying, like, I can't talk about it, but you'll see it in season two.
Yeah.
All that stuff is really great. I think it's just a really good show. And I feel like he's other like documentary filmmakers like Nathan Fielder or Brett Story, these other people who are, or even like Theo Anthony, these sort of like avant-garde experimental documentary filmmakers. He's kind of part of that world in a way, but also it's really funny and it's really touching.
Yeah.
I had to be in a very particular mood to watch that show, but when I do, I always enjoy it. But the first episode of this new season about real estate,
it stressed me out so much.
It stressed me out so much because everything goes wrong. And it just like the decisions being made. And like I think the way, and again, I don't know if it's manufactured or not, but the way he sort of like earns trust and gets all these side stories going is sort of like this naivete that he presents, whether that's manufactured and that's just how he presents in order to get people opened up. Hey, kudos to him if that's not, you know, the true self and that's just how he as a filmmaker gets people to take him back to their house and show them fucking ventriloquist tricks and stuff. But that one episode about real estate, and I don't want to spoil it, but like it's just the odyssey of not only buying real estate, but buying real estate in New York City, which is like a double extra secret probation nightmare.
Yeah. Let me ask you, I don't know if you're caught up on the show. That episode is very stressful.
Yeah.
I will raise you by saying the episode about parking.
Okay.
To quote my lovely wife, that is one of the most stressful things I have ever watched. And okay. I totally agree.
That's something to look forward to. We've only watched the first one so far.
Yeah, because that episode you're citing, Dave, is definitely stressful. The parking one tops it.
Okay, great.
You will never want to drive a car ever.
Oh, my God.
I do. Yeah. Parking stresses me out to start with. I always do think about, like, I always think ahead about what the parking sitch is going to be wherever I go.
Yeah,
and
totally.
I will get stressed about it in advance. And especially if there's like valet parking involved, which makes me uncomfortable just on sort of an upstairs, downstairs kind of way, you know? Like, it's a really good show. And when I say it stresses me out, it stresses me out in a very entertaining way. But like it really stabs you when it wants to.
No, there are definitely shows like that where I feel like I need to watch it in bright daylight.
Yes.
So that you can then have like hours to recover from it.
It's an old person horror show.
Yeah. Yeah.
Neat. Anything to plug there, Tim?
You mentioned the Grierson and Leach podcast. I guess I'll plug that. I sort of write everywhere, but I'm, you know, it's the end of the year and I'm legally required to give like top 10 list to every place that I write for, which is flattering and nice. I always feel like the official one is the one that my old buddy and I, Will Leach, do on our Grierson and Leach podcast. That will be probably coming out December 22nd. Depends on how long we ramble. So it'll be December 22nd, sort of our holiday treat to the listener as we go through our top 10 list together. It is a activity that we have done since we were in high school together, sharing our top 10 list together. It is either the dorkiest thing imaginable or the most endearing thing imaginable. We have literally been doing it, and we're very, very serious about it. We have very strict rules about how all this stuff goes. So Will has no idea what my top 10 is. I have no idea what his is. That podcast will be dropping on the 22nd.
Oh, boy. We'll link to that and all your other stuff in our show notes.
Sarah D. Bundy.
So talk about not exploring what true crime documentaries can be. It's Dead Asleep, which came out on Hulu last week. It is the new true crime documentary from Skye Borgman, who directed the very buzzy a few years ago Abducted in Plain Sight. It is about the murder of Brooke Preston in 2017 by her roommate, Randy Herman Jr. Herman admitted that he did it and called the cops on himself, but also claimed he was sleepwalking at the time. This is a compelling case in that it raises interesting questions about parasomnias as diminished capacity. And Borgman is not incompetent at like picking kind of crazy cases and like drawing you in that way. And also, you know, like there are documentary basics that I feel like they may just issue some kind of like Alexa plug and play thing that people can just do at home that comes with like, you know, play school, my first drone shot of a water tower, whatever. That said, Dead Asleep isn't very good. The Preston family declined to participate in it. A lot of the talking heads feel half-baked and not very authoritative. It does that let's give them a sizzle reel of the thing they're already watching thing up top, like, please stop doing that, true crime properties. But what I found the most interesting about Dead Asleep in the end was how much certain other reviewers hated it, like out of proportion to its sins, in my opinion. Again, it does commit sins. It is not great. But a couple of these reviews seem to be as much about end of the year slash genre burnout as they were about the documentary itself. Like, this is really no garbagier than your average network news mag. But everyone in the space is just exhausted from not just the glut of true crime programming like Tiger King ancillary garbaggio alone, but also in how much meta-analysis we've been doing of the genre in the last year and a half. I absolutely get the frustration, I really do, but I don't think you can blame this one film for the sins of basically a demand-side quality issue created by streaming services. Dead Asleep does do some things wrong, but some of these reviews read like maybe the real problem is overworked critics trying to cover a huge waterfront when they're not in a union. Just me? Who can say? Any hoodle, long story short, it's not that terrible, but you don't need to watch it, A, and B, yes. Three listeners who know my other interests in the scripted space, there was an SVU episode about sexsomnia, sort of, except that case happened well before this one in real life and was a pre-credits red herring that led the squad accidentally to the real case in the episode in season 9, episode 2, Avatar, my all-time no-nackiest favorite camp SVU classic, in which Benson
soon, man.
Orders the Zuckerberg of the show's fake Second Life to, and I quote, turn on the sun, which I will do in a no-nack presentation in 2022.
Yes!
I promise. Prior to that grand event, you can read my full review of Dead Asleep and Professor Dan Cassino's piece on the forgotten murder of Jane Stanford at the newsletter that I write with Eve Beatty, Best Evidence. That's at bestevidence.fyi. There will be a link in the show notes. Most content is free, so come on by. Let us know what you will be reading in the genre over the break.
Today's extra credit topic comes to us from John Potts. It is titled TV Getaways, and John writes, it's holiday season, but what with one thing or another, a lot of places are unreachable at the moment. But we always have TV, so what show would you like to spend a week's holiday in? It has to be set in the world of the show, so if you want to visit Korea, you could choose MASH, but you'd be visiting during the Korean War. That looked a lot like Vietnam, filmed in California. Top-notch healthcare, though. I will go first because I have two. My first selection is, as we saw in the season 2 finale, On a Yacht with the Roys in Succession, where you get waited on hand and foot, you get a ringside seat to scandalous drama, blood sacrifices and whatnot. There's lots of chicken for me to steal off motherfuckers' plates to prove my dominance. There are estheticians available for threesomes. It's got everything you want. But my second choice, in keeping with the season, is The New York of Dash and Lily, where you get,
because
it is set at Christmas time, winter clothes, cozy New York shopping and picturesque snow, a scavenger hunt from an intriguing stranger. And in this fantasy, I'm also in high school, so I only have very manageable high school problems.
And omnipresent warm lighting.
Yes, I will look amazing.
Nobody else in the entire city, which frankly is the best part of New York at the holidays. Let's not lie.
Tim.
I kept trying to think of a better answer and I realized, no, it has to be Cheers. It has to be the bar in Cheers. Now, being at the bar in Cheers during the holidays, I don't know if that's going to be super beyond depressing, but I don't think so, because I think that crew of people would be a group of people that you'd want to spend the holidays with. Maybe not Cliff so much, but I have to say, as I get older and I meet Cliffs in my adult life, I've kind of learned how to handle them, to be perfectly honest. I really have. I mean, it's, I have to deal with enough know-it-alls in my life that I feel like I now had to kind of tune them out and sort of like tolerate them. And also I kind of understand that deep down, they just want someone to listen to them. And so I'm sympathetic enough, I can do that. But that crew, and I have to say, if I had to choose, it's early Cheers. I would rather hang out with Diane than Rebecca, So I want like the first few seasons, not the later seasons. But the tough question I had was, do I want Coach or do I want Woody?
Right.
That's a hard one. I think I'd probably still want Woody. I love Coach. Love, love, love him. And I still remember being a kid and him dying and me like, that was like one of the first like TV deaths I had to process as a boy. And it's still kind of traumatic for me, but I think I would probably still take the Woody era of the show. So I would, that's, if I have to spend some place with, for the holidays, that's the one I'm picking.
I love it.
Yeah, that's pretty good.
I think that's, and I think their a Thanksgiving episode of theirs was wedged into the canon by me, thanks to a food fight. But
I actually rewatched that on Thanksgiving because I love the episode.
If you don't mind airborne mashed potatoes at Carla's house, I'm with it.
Sarah.
I'm going with Downton Abbey. Fireplaces in every room, gorgeous furnishings, and old books from literally floor to ceiling in multiple rooms, a cute dog to snorkel, a nice lady to dress me and braid my hair each night before bed, plus no internet. Now, is a week of British weather prior to the invention of television 3 or 4 days too many? Maybe. Do I have to pick my season of the show carefully so that Mr. Pamuk is not marauding around, nor is my little pinko doppelhyson Sarah Bunting showing up to cause confusion slash open up a time portal because we're both in the same room at the same time? Yes, I do. But I think there's a holiday window in there. I will see you in the library with some port. Cheers. Dave.
I instantly had my answer, and then I was like reevaluating. Is there a better answer? No, I couldn't figure it out. That is New New York from Futurama, which I feel like I would be a lot like when Fry first is unfrozen in the year 3000. It's just bewilderment and excitement. But like, I feel like I would also be the one, you know, champing at the bit to go to the moon. Mm-hmm. And like all the things that everybody in the year 3000 is really banal, but is super exciting to me. And, you know, being a kid raised on Star Wars and the promise of Star Trek and all the things that are going to happen in our future, which I feel like just now as I approach 50 are starting to trickle in for real. Like, I feel like the iPhones type of stuff was like the first big one where I'm like, wow, the world is in your pocket now. Like, that was the first thing. These things are happening, but if I can like accelerate that process, it would definitely be New York. You know, you got aliens as well, so you got that whole thing. There is a lot of like low-level threat stuff that happens in New York inside of Futurama, but I feel like it's all comic mischief, and I don't think I would actually die. So
at Christmas time, you might.
That's true. That's true. It's a good point. But I know about it, so I would stay inside.
Right.
But yeah, I would absolutely go to New York in Futurama. And I'm a little bit sad I can't, frankly.
Okay.
That was the saddest catch register thing ever. Cha-ching. It is time for the Extra Hot Great Canon. Presenting this week is Elon. Take it away, Elon.
I know my punishment might seem a little harsh, but I can't go back on it. You're welcome to watch anything you want on TV.
TV sucks.
I know you're upset right now, so I'll pretend you didn't say that.
Hello, Extra Hot Great team. I'm Elon, and I'm here to plead the case for The Simpsons, Season 4, Episode 6, Itchy and Scratchy, the Movie. Note that I started thinking about this episode in 2015, then threw it on the back burner and had children, then my old laptop died and I couldn't pull the DVD clips, and then 2016 came and nothing mattered for a while. When Tara put out the call to clear the queue, I loaded it up, and here it is. Bad ideas and all. So in 2015, I saw Don Hertzfeldt's couch gag, thinking about where The Simpsons is going. This is the one where The Simpsons is 10 zillion years in the future and everything is about the moon god and their abstract pixels floating around. This is Don Hertzfeldt of The World of Tomorrow, some amazing animated shorts, just a really cool animator. So thinking about this, does The Simpsons have an end? Could it go on forever? And I thought about the episode that sort of told the whole story of The Simpsons all at once. It had been almost a year since Simpsons producer Sam Simon passed away. Now, there's some suggestion that he pitched the original idea for this episode, though apparently the second half diverged from his outline. Still, it's sad that he's gone, putting aside the cultural reckoning with many of the Simpsons' cultural blind spots, and it's also great that this episode survives. So, for my canon submission, I'm submitting what was, at the time, the first Simpsons episode for the new podcast, and this was before Steppenwall and Caroline had submitted theirs. So, it's not one of the Count 'em 8 from Ray's original Extra Hot Great Simpsons episode submissions, which I'll note never failed to make the canon, so please note that if this one doesn't make it, the shame would be unbearable. There are many, many ways to choose a favorite Simpsons episode. Funniest, joke densest, most memorable, most quotable. For the record, I think that the sharpest Simpsons episode would be Homie the Clown, where Homer becomes a franchise Krusty and then goes on the run from the mob. But episode 6 of season 4, Itchy and Scratchy the Movie, is the one I consider canon worthy. I'll try to exploit my own book smarts to articulate a case. The episode was directed by Rich Moore, and writing was credited to the prolific and fundamental John Swartzwelder, sort of a real-life Ron Swanson, sometimes uncomfortably libertarian, and disciple of classic Americana and all things old-timey. Thematically, it also echoes Matt Groening's early assertion that the show is fundamentally a meditation on the nature of authority. Homer and Bart's father-son relationship, both as a power structure and as a loving family, is at the heart of this episode. We start with one of the show's more on-point movie digs, prophetically suggesting the theme of extruding a television property into a creatively threadbare movie, Star Trek, So Very Tired.
Captain, Klingons off the starboard bow.
Again with the Klingons.
Rest in peace, Leonard Nimoy. This being early Simpsons, the plot is about to zag and hit top speed, as Marge and Homer are off to parent-teacher night. Lisa's inevitably going to get a glowing report, and Bart will be basically tried for war crimes. But we set up the theme of consequences in this next clip.
Now be good for Grandpa while we're at the parent-teacher meeting. We'll bring back dinner.
What are we gonna have?
Well, that depends on what your teachers say. If you've been good, pizza. If you've been bad, let's see, poison.
What if one of us has been good and one of us has been bad? Poison pizza.
Oh no, I'm not making two stops.
If it were up to me, I'd just have this episode played in its entirety as my submission, but this episode tells its story so efficiently that we have to keep moving. Marge grudgingly agrees to meet Bart's teacher, Homer to meet Lisa's, and we speed past Homer honking USA, USA in triumph as he gloats. So it's parent-teacher night. Lisa's been exemplary. Bart, on the other hand, has found terrifying ways to be a disruptive idiot. Krabappel marches out a stream of witnesses for Marge and then lays it out for the parents, giving the episode its thesis statement in our next, slightly longer clip.
I think the problem here is discipline. If Bart does something wrong, you should punish him.
Well, we try. But he has this way of making us think we've punished him when actually we've completely caved in.
He's the boy you love to hate.
Well, you've got to start being firm with him. I believe with persistent discipline, even the poorest student can end up becoming, oh, say, Chief Justice of the Supreme Court.
Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. What great men he would join. John Marshall, Charles Evans Hughes, Warren Burger. Burger.
And what if we don't?
Then there's no telling how low he can sink.
And of course, it takes a moment to shame sex workers. Again, not ideal. Problematic Simpsons. But here is our dichotomy. Bart will either be Chief Justice of the Supreme Court or, in Marge's later words, a sleazy male stripper. Pizza or poison, there's no in-between. Accepting this absurd Schwartzwelderian premise is central to this episode. I'm going to pause at this juncture and point out this is still early mid-Simpsons. The show still had its middle-class heart on its sleeve. This is the show that, when George H.W. Bush contrasted it with the Waltons, actually had a case it could make for himself. There was a morality at play. Characters still wanted the best for each other. Note that it's implied that Homer knows his way around the history of the Supreme Court of the United States. Homer's optimistic, unrealistic, and sometimes thick, but he's not yet terminally stupid or crazy. So, Randolph. Homer and Marge arrive back home with pizza, no poison. Bart has perpetrated further lunatic tomfoolery, breaking Grandpa's teeth by using them to hang on to the spinning ceiling fan while listening to an LP of Kachaturian Saber Dance because it's stylish lunatic tomfoolery. Marge sends him to his room without dinner at first, and lo, he starts to think seriously about what he's done. Then Homer shows up in our next clip and brought Chekhov's pizza with him in this very short clip that's here for a reason.
Gee, maybe they mean it this time. From now on, I guess I better straighten up and fly.
Bart, don't tell your mother, but I brought you some pizza. Just promise me you'll try to be good.
I promise.
Attaboy.
Sucker.
On my soapbox again, we can see how much Homer loves Bart, and he thinks things will work out. And Bart seems like he's going to try, too, for a second. As a footnote, now that I'm a dad, and that happened since I wrote this initial submission, this hits different now. The battle between giving in and letting my stressed four-year-old play his Mario Kart methadone, especially during COVID days, versus trying to hold firm and getting to play outside in the snow or something, really pulls at my heartstrings. All right, the curtain rises on Act 2, where an Itchy and Scratchy the Movie finally makes its appearance. I'm not going to spend too much time on the movie itself. It's there with 53% new footage. The kids can't wait to see it. Meanwhile, Bart keeps perpetrating additional shenanigans, but continues to escape punishment, distracting Homer with ice cream trucks, questions about how to get out of jury duty, and the first appearance of the bee guy from the unpredictable Mexican sitcoms. Marge and Lisa are out shopping for beets, Homer's watching TV, and Bart just cold starts ripping up the carpet. Marge once again rips into Homer, who counters with further American history knowledge in our next clip.
How could you let this happen?
How could you let this happen?
I wasn't here.
Oh, how convenient.
Homer, do you want your son to become Chief Justice of the Supreme Court or a sleazy male stripper?
Can't he be both, like the late Earl Warren?
Earl Warren wasn't a stripper.
Now, who's being naive?
Again, it's 2021, and maybe humor about Supreme Court justices has lost its sheen. Maybe I'm the one being naive. The Itchy and Scratchy movie is looming closer now. Kent Brockman takes us on a tour of Itchy and Scratchy history from the memorable, if mostly visual, Steamboat Itchy to an eyebrow-raising glimpse at a Korean animation facility. Simpsons. Bart is transfixed and doesn't notice that Maggie has taken the car for a joyride. Interestingly, this is a scene promised in the show's opening credits every week, so returning to foundational Simpsons territory. Maggie plows into the Springfield Penitentiary. Another moment of synchronicity and allegory follows with one of my favorite throwaway gags ever on TV, so I am once again asking you to roll clip.
All right, time for a crime spree.
All right, boy, this calls for the biggest punishment I ever handed down, and this time it's gonna stick.
Come on, Homer, this isn't funny.
Damn right. Bart, you can't go to see that Itchy and Scratchy movie ever!
Oh no, Beta!
A snake is holding a VCR there for you young people. Now that I think about it, you really need to be very old to get this joke. Maybe 10 years ago, he'd be carrying what he thinks is a Blu-ray player. He finds out it's HD DVD or something. It's funny how Autogyro from the Prussian consulate in Siam catches up with all of us. So Lisa does get to see the movie. She means well, but can't help rubbing it in Bart's face. We get a short reminder of Simpsons historical Easter eggs in our next super short clip.
And you wouldn't believe the celebrities who did cameos. Dustin Hoffman, Michael Jackson. Of course, they didn't use their real names, but you could tell it was them.
Both utterly canceled since this episode aired. And I wonder if they've cut that line out of the episode since they're no longer re-airing the Michael Jackson one. And I don't even know if they're still showing the Dustin Hoffman one. Anyway, onward. Bart gets teased at school for not seeing it by as unlikely an alliance as Nelson and Milhouse. It's abject misery for him. Marge and Lisa are willing to let Homer off the hook, and Bart is really suffering here, and Homer can stop it, but he also can't. There is some mythic resonance here, not to oversell this cartoon show. Damn it, roll clip.
Homer, we'd like to talk to you.
But then I won't be watching TV. You can see the bind I'm in.
Dad, you've got to let Bart see that movie. I've never seen him like this. He has the demented melancholia of a Tennessee Williams heroine.
Don't you think I know that?
Well, it's been 2 months. You laid down the law, and I'm proud of you. But I think we've gotten through them.
Ah, sweet, soft-hearted Marge. You just can't see the big picture. If I stick to my guns, the boy could wind up Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. If I fail, the best he could do is judge at a Mr. Tight Buns competition. I can't let that happen. I won't let that happen, and I can't let that happen.
I have tears in my eyes. I can't tell if these are laugh tears or cry tears. Bart still makes one last attempt to see the movie, but the acne-ridden, mid-voice change movie clerk tells Bart that they promised his dad they wouldn't sell him a ticket. Homer had actually covered all the angles. Homer had done his homework. Homer never does the homework. And it works. Bart doesn't see the movie. The punishment stuck, movie closes, and Homer wins in our next clip.
I'm here at the Springfield Aztec Theater, where, after 8 months and 9 Academy Awards, the Itchy and Scratchy movie is showing for the last time. Tomorrow, a new movie starring Liza Minnelli and Mickey Rourke will open. Will it be as successful? Only time will tell.
Well, Dad, I guess you won.
No, son, we both won. You don't know it now, but I've started you on the road to somewhere very special.
Last scene, it's the future. Bart is Chief Justice at the Supreme Court. They see the movie together. It's overpriced. Homer, slowing down a bit, observes that Itchy's a jerk, and the two of them laugh together. The end. So this is the end of the episode, and for what it's worth, to me, this is the scene that comes at the end of The Simpsons, whenever the hell that goes off the air in the next 7 million AD, I don't know. But where has it taken us? Well, first of all, Bart's complex relationship with Rebellion was leading all the way to the other end of the authority spectrum. Lisa, we presume, will be president. We all know she does fine. But also, Bart is at the movies with Homer, and Homer can rest, knowing he's done the right things as a father. Bart can relate to his dad as another person. And the burden of authority is lifted for both of them. So damn hell-ass many Simpsons themes come together in this final sequence. The cyclical evolution and devolution of American culture, the progression from Lil Stinker Bart to Judge Bart, again, maybe not so far a journey, and maybe that's another point the episode is unconsciously making at this point. And that fundamental truth of Homer as a loving, well-meaning father, actually in step with Marge, and ultimately, this wins out over his lunkheadedness. It all boils down into the thesis statement for the entire series. Your family can seem stupid and frustrating. Sometimes your parents make decisions that you don't understand as a kid. But if you're lucky, I know not everyone is, but in this schema, they love you. And they'll fight you to do what's right for you. Make no mistake, it's a very sentimental episode. Maybe it goes too far. But it still moves fast. The jokes are packed tighter than a young Rainier Wolfcastle's butt into a pair of Austrian leather shorts. Narratively, it cuts away everything but the vulnerable beating heart of The Simpsons and shows it to us with unabashed sincerity. Humbly submitted for your consideration, The Simpsons Season 4, Episode 6, Itchy and Scratchy the Movie.
Tim, you chose this from our list of submissions. Why don't you start?
I have to say, that's a very eloquent case that he makes for the show, for that episode. What's funny for me is that Season 4 is a really, really good season of The Simpsons, I feel like. I feel like in a lot of ways, it's when the show, I think, really kind of like started to become the show in a lot of ways. And to kind of dissect a couple of the points that he brings up, and I'm glad he referenced the Michael Jackson episode and the Dustin Hoffman that are both, they're both mentioned in this episode. Because in terms of just sheer emotional devastation in episodes, those are two of the biggest that absolutely just floor me. There's like, you know, again, those are problematic figures, but those episodes work extremely well. And the reason why that they work so well is that it talks about what he is talking about that this episode, I don't think, does as well, which is that that was the period of The Simpsons where it was really about the idea of a family and the dynamic of a family. And in the, obviously in the Dustin Hoffman episode, it's about Lisa feeling not appreciated by her father.
Yeah.
And that episode is about her finding somebody else, finding another father figure. And it's a really emotional episode. And the Michael Jackson episode is about Bart doing something sweet for his sister. And Lisa, I mean, they're both kind of about Lisa not feeling very appreciated, I suppose. Mm-hmm. And I think both of those work for what he's talking about in Itchy and Scratchy the Movie. I think Itchy and Scratchy the Movie is a good episode and a funny episode. But I started writing down other episodes from Season 4. And obviously this is all subjective. But I think Homer's Triple Bypass, which is the first episode I ever watched, Marge versus the Monorail, Selma's Choice, I Love Lisa, Mr. Plow, The Third Treehouse of Horror, which was also that season, and A Streetcar Named Marge, to me are stronger, more complete complete episodes. I have to say his take I thought was actually, it actually made me, because I went into this being like, it's a good episode, but it's not one of the greats. His defense of it and the way he sees it, I think, is really interesting. I would just say that for me, depending on how you measure these things, how funny it is, how emotional it is, how memeable the episode has been, I don't think it rises to the same level. I actually like what he had to say about where it ultimately goes, this flash forward of what Homer imagines. I like when movies do this sometimes, like 25th Hour, where they imagine a future that we actually don't know is going to happen or not, but it's what one character wants.
Right.
It's a really sweet ending for this episode. I just found that the actual plot of it to be not as strong, and some of the stuff between Homer and Bart to not be as strong, because I have to say that in general, Homer and Lisa's conflict in episodes, I have often found more poignant and more touching. And Homer and Bart, though I like them when they get into shenanigans together, their emotional bond I haven't always found as strong. So for me, like, I don't think it's canon worthy. I'm sorry.
Okay. Sarah.
This was an excellent presentation that got me a little closer to a yes, but I'm not sure it's going to put me over. And I think it's because it feels like if this same script had been made in like season 5 or 6, that it would have been a little more, more of both, more sure-footed about the more like sentimental and sort of not joke dense parts. And there are stretches in here where it is not joke dense, which is fine, but it's also, it seems to be like looking around a little bit for the feeling which is less fine because when you're expecting sort of a peak Simpsons and then it's slightly under that in terms of the confidence and the pace, it's more noticeable. Of course, there are also some things that, you know, no longer work here in 2021. There are a lot of things that do. I'm not making two stops. Like, for some reason, I just fell out laughing at that line. Like, I've seen this episode before. It's like, oh, I'm not making two stops. Like, that's perfect. I mean, there are a lot of things about this that are peak Simpsons that are really good. I'm glad that he called out the fact that Homer is not this, like, suffering from a traumatic brain injury, which, like, starting in, like, season 9, I'm going to say, it just was, like...
Oh, earlier than that.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So this was, like, a refreshing sort of return to when this was, like, a sort of believable character versus a, like, one-note, I don't know, dumb repeater, like his automatic birdie. Yeah, I don't know. Like, this is good. I enjoyed it. I especially enjoyed the presentation. I liked thinking about it from this perspective of family-based storytelling, which is maybe not necessarily how, that's not the way into a Simpsons presentation that we might usually hear around here. So I definitely appreciated that, but I think, you know, the canon is like the Simpsons wing is like, talk about dense. Like, there's not a lot of shelf space left, and I'm not sure this gets a spot. That said, I'm probably the least Simpsons conversant person in the room right now. So I'm going to turn it over to David T. Cole.
I agree with what Tim said. It is like close, but it's not quite there, that there are better exemplars of Simpsons being at its peak, which is stupid jokes, but still has a family sitcom at the heart of it before, as Sarah said, Homer suffers irreparable brain damage and becomes an easy vehicle for stupider jokes that get laughs, but at the expense of the family dynamic. That is not to say that this episode isn't really good and has some, like, lots of lines that I still use to this day. The Simpsons part of the canon, we've got a lot of things in there. I love to hear Simpsons canon arguments, but it's going to get tougher and tougher, right? Because the more we put in, the more we have to, like, compare and contrast on what's there. And it's worth noting that the canon, the original idea of the canon, was actually which Simpsons episodes are the best Simpsons episodes. And then I just said, well, that's great, but let's just do it for everything and make it Hall of Fame.
Yes.
So there's a reason why those first couple years of Extra Hot Great had so many Simpsons things, because it was sort of like the genesis of the idea. It's close, but there's better ones that mix the family dynamic that is the heart of this show and the stupid jokes that open the door. Oh, one more correction.
Yeah.
It's Bumblebee Man.
What did he say?
B-Guy.
Oh, B-Guy. Yes, it is Bumblebee Man. I won't say this presentation talked me out of putting it in, but there certainly is a lot that I do not agree with. Starting with, and maybe it's just because I am not a parent, but when he says it's a very sentimental episode, I don't agree that it is.
He's been infected by the cat.
That's
the
right.
Yeah.
you had a baby and you went soft. I get it. I know that this happens to people, not me. Couldn't be me. But I mean, I take your point. I get how that ending would, you know, would get you if you were a dad now. But in terms of, like, whether it's Homer's imagination of how things are going to go for Bart, like, it doesn't conform with the canon of the show, given stuff that happens later. Sorry to be that guy, A. But B, it doesn't even conform to, like, Bart in the next 50 episodes. Like, Bart, this doesn't actually change anything. Of course it can't, because it's a sitcom. But on top of that, Bart is still bad. Like, this punishment, this carceral solution, if I may, does not actually work.
You may.
And, you know, all the things about Homer, like, this is a time when Homer could make jokes about Supreme Court justices. The joke is how improbable that is. You know what I mean? Like, the joke is that this is not a Homer joke. It's a Lisa joke in Homer's mouth. And that's why it's funny, because Homer doesn't know this stuff.
But then it's the burger at the end. That brings
yes,
it back.
Exactly.
Well, and that he didn't mention Felix Frankfurter was, I felt, admirable restraint by the writers. Doesn't mean I'm going to vote for it, but duly noted.
As Dave said, it has a lot of good jokes. I always like an itchy and scratchy gag because it doesn't go where you think it's going to go, and those are always funny. And there definitely are several lines in this one that are in our permanent lexicon. Let's get him a present.
Yeah.
Used often about our new dog who ate a book a couple of weeks ago.
Time for a crime spree.
It did. It was sitting there on the floor, and she just got it, too. Like, it was
day,
like
literally the day before.
It was like a one day in the house book. If we walk in there, it's just a trend. Yeah. We're just looking at each other. It's like, and he's just like being cute afterwards. Oh, let's buy him a present. Yes.
We got beats. Like, why? Total non sequitur of a joke. It's completely funny. We learned about owls. Like, any joke like that about from Lisa is funny to me. I'm not making two stops. You know, then I wouldn't be watching TV. You see the bind I'm in, etc. And Bart, like, saying, you know, anything that they can come up with can't compete with my imagination. And his imagination is completely blank. It's like, there really are good gags. But yeah, to everyone else's point, like, it's tough, but it doesn't get there for me. I will say, if you want to be a judge at a Mr. Tight Buns competition, watch Finding Magic Mike on HBO Max.
Two last quick things. Number one, I also don't think it's a great itchy and scratchy commentary. Mm. I think other ones, like whether it's the Poochie episode or an episode from this season, The Front,
yeah,
I think are actually better itchy and scratchy episodes.
Mm-hmm.
And in terms of references, I watched this episode again for the first time in forever last night. I now realize that for the last 20-something years, when I pretend I'm falling off of something and I yell, I regret nothing,
yeah,
it came from this episode. I actually said out loud, oh my God, that's what it's from. I actually had forgotten where it came from, and it was shocking to see it in this episode.
Yes.
That's happened a lot during the canon presentations for some of those
episodes. I thought it was Hank Scorpio episode. I don't know why, but anyway, doesn't matter.
Anyway, save Scrap Iron, everybody.
Yeah. All right, let's put this to the official vote. Tim, what say you? Canon worthy or nay?
Nay.
Sarah D. Bunting.
Presentation, yay. Episode itself, nay. Sorry, Elon, but thank you.
Dara.
I regret to say it is a nay for me as well.
All right, so I will also say nay. That means, unfortunately, although the presentation was really good, The Simpsons, Season 4, Episode 6, Itchy and Scratchy, the movie, you're hereby not inducted into the Extra Hot Great Canon.
Americans love a winner.
Yup.
And will not tolerate a loser.
Nope.
It's time for the winner and the loser of the week. Sarah has this week's winner.
Dave, can you play that beautiful Texas sound drop for me, please?
That's what I like about Texas.
Monthly.
I like a few things. One of those things is Texas Monthly, to which I subscribe in print because it's so good. It's true crime pieces in particular. And the magazine has signed a first look deal with HBO and HBO Max. I presume probably to adapt that programming. There have been a ton of pieces that have been adapted into features, docudramas. The movie Bernie, starring Jack Black, was based on a piece in that fine magazine written by, I think, the great Skip Hollandsworth. Anyway, this is good news for fans of the genre. I know I just spent 10 minutes talking about how burned out we all are on it, but it still is capable of great things. And this is a great deal for consumers and magazine alike.
Make the Phil Collins, Davy Crockett movie.
Oh my God. Yes. Jesus. Remember the Alamo always.
Yeah.
All right. Tara has this week's loser.
Well, what a difference a week makes. Last week, we talked about And Just Like That. We barely talked about, I think someone said in passing that Mr. Big's character dies after a Peloton ride in it. That is what happened, spoiler. I don't think it's possible not to know that at this point. But anyway, so they rushed a Peloton ad to the internet. It was very cheeky. It starred Chris Noth. It winked at his death. It featured the woman who played his Peloton instructor in the show. And then it got taken offline because there are sexual assault allegations against Chris Noth by two women, and the dominoes continued to fall after that. Zoe Lister-Jones posted that he was a creep to her and also drunk on set when they were both on Law & Order. His agency dropped him. His tequila brand is no more. He got fired from The Equalizer. And The Three, and Just Like That, ladies, released a statement saying they support the women who have come forward. So RIP, Chris Noss' career. Yikes.
Yeah, the drunk on set stuff had been an open secret in NYC for like a quarter of a century. But this other stuff, I guess, you know.
Yeah.
Sadly, it's never a surprise at this point, but that was new. So.
It's not. And I saw several people on Twitter being like, this comes as no surprise to anyone who went to NYU and got perved on by him, like, because he was just
that
around.
Is true.
So.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Speak about Good save, oh, no. Cole. Do you know what time it is?
It's game time.
It's game time.
All right, guys, this is the fifth game time of the season. The season scores are Tara with 2, Sarah with 1, Value Guess with 1. Today, we are playing the Caroling Burnett Show 2 from Sully Rhymes with Julie, who earns himself an extra credit topic. Sully is back with a sequel to last year's holiday game time. Sully is going to sing you a Christmas carol with TV lyrics, and you tell me what before and after style title that song creates. For example, here is one from last year.
Said the talking dog to the strung out team, roo-roo-ree-rut-ri-ree, ringing through the sky, stoner boy.
So the TV show and the title of that carol will mash up together. So the answer there would be what?
Scooby, do you hear what I hear?
Scooby, do you hear what I hear? Yes, that is the way this goes. Now, last year we had some trip-ups with just naming some carols, so I'm going to adjust the scoring this year. You will get 2 points if you just name the show, but if you can actually name the title, the full title, you will get 3 points.
Okay.
To sort of equalize things a little bit for those who may not be carol conversant. So with that, let's throw it to Picky to see who's going first.
We will start with Valued Guest.
All right, that means Tim has to go first, and then we'll go to Tara, then Sarah. Are we ready to play the Caroling Burnett Show 2?
Yes.
Yes.
Yes, sir.
No hints in this game, so we'll just get right to it. Here is your first carol, Tim.
A folksy football coach is hired to tank a soccer team to get back at a skeezy ex. It's quite the harebrained scheme.
All right, there is the carol. So I will tell you, the show comes first in the mashed up title here.
Okay. Can I talk it out or do I have to just
you? Absolutely.
You
please show your work.
Okay. Well, the show is Ted Lasso. And I was just trying to figure out what melody that was. Is it Ted Lasso Bethlehem?
I'll give you that. Ted Lasso, Little Town of Bethlehem. So that's good enough for me. 3 points. All right, Tara, here is your first girl.
Okay.
Young heroes in Jump City, fighting crime and the bad guys. Cyborg, Raven, and Starfire. Not Marvel, but DC.
Teen Titans Go Tell It on the Mountain.
Perfect. 3 points for Tara. All right, Sarah, see if you can also get 3. No pressure. Here we go.
In the Bay Area, there is crime and there's death. And the show is about those who drew their last breath. Just one homicide case will you see each season, delving into each part of its rhyme and reason.
All right, I'll let you know the show is also first in this mashup title.
Okay. I think this is Murder in the First Noel.
It is Murder in the First Noel. Everybody has 3 points.
I was the only
points.
One who watched that show. Thanks, Vicky.
Back to Tim.
They study human intercourse. They study human intercourse. They study human intercourse in the 1950s.
That That should have been a carol.
I will let you know that the show is last in this mashup.
Okay, that's why I was confused. Okay, yes. Is it We Wish You a Merry Christmasters of Sex?
Yes, We Wish You a Merry Christmasters of Sex.
Christmas of Sex, yeah.
Nice.
Perfect. All right, another three points for Tim.
How unconfident I sound saying that one. Yeah, I was like, that sounds right, but that was a difficult pun, but I got there.
Yep. All right, Tara, here is your next carol. Show is second part of the title.
Okay.
I am not your average lady. I've got personalities. A housewife, redneck, and a teen. All of them inside of me. I can't control when they come out. It's a wild ride, that's no doubt. It got canceled way too soon.
All I want for Christmas is United States of Tara.
Yes, correct. All right, perfect game so far. Back to Sarah D. Bunting.
There is a serial killer in Belfast. Yes, he's in Belfast. He's in Belfast. If only we could catch this guy, then young ladies could rest easier.
The show is first in this mashup title.
La 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 la.
Thank you so much for that. That did not help at all.
All right.
The First Street of San Francisco. Sorry, I don't know this one at all.
Anybody not? No points?
The Fall I Want for Christmas is My Two Front Teeth.
Yes, correct.
Oh, right. Okay.
Okay, back to Tim.
Titanic Flight 815 crashed somewhere at sea. Luckily there is some land. How bad could it be? Polar bears and smoke monsters and conspiracies. Poorly thought out story arcs with crazy French ladies.
All right, the show is the last part of the before and after title there.
That song is on the tip of my tongue, but I'm not. I know it's Lost.
Okay, there's 2 points. I'll get you two.
I'll stick with Lost, yeah.
Okay, Lost is correct. That is worth two. A little bit of a stretch, but Jolly Old Saint Nicholas was the title. Right. There.
I would have said Good King Wenceslas, even though I knew that wasn't the.
All right, Tar, here we go.
Two brothers have magic, or maybe it's weird science. One soul is stuck inside a suit of armor. They unearth a dark plot to kill thousands of people. There's 7 deadly sins. What are homunculi? What more logic do you want? It's an anime.
Well, I'm never going to get it, but it's O Come All Ye Faithful or Adeste Fidelis. So I'll take 1 point for the song, but I have no idea what the show is.
You don't get 1 point for the song.
Then fuck me.
All right. That's Come All Ye Faithful Men.
Oh, I'll Come All Ye Faithful Metal Alchemist.
All right. Right. No points there for Tara. We are back to Sarah. This will be our half point in the game. We'll take us into our score break. Here you go.
Copies of dead famous folks. All together in a school. Lots of historical jokes make this cartoon very cool.
All right, the show is at the end. It's a little bit of a stick-it-in ending there.
Angels, We Have Heard Clone High?
Yes, that's correct. All right, that will take us into our first score break. Tara, what are our scores, please? There.
It's very close, Dave.
Yeah, thank you.
Tim is in the lead with 8 points. Sarah and I are tied with 6 APs.
All right.
Dun, dun, dun.
Everybody has 3 carols left. Let's throw it back to Tim.
Hitler's a bad guy, but he didn't lose the war. Juliana Crane really has no point. How'd the show become such a bore?
And the show is the last part of the title.
thank you, that helps. Frosty the Snowman in the High Tower.
Yes.
Oh, you were so close.
Oh no.
Was Frosty the Snowman in the High Castle.
Castle, sorry. Oh,
you're close. Plus, that one's going to haunt you, maybe. That might haunt you.
Yes. It's already haunting me now, so I'm already there.
Turn.
Yep.
A pig, bear, and frog, all in one nursery. A gonzo and dog, all in one nursery. Since this show is on, so many years have gone by. It just came back, but now it's in CGI.
I don't know what the song is.
All right,
it's
the show,
babies.
The show is first.
Uh-huh.
And it's like not really a carol, it's a Christmas song.
I still don't know Muppet Babies.
Okay, Muppet Babies, whoops, is good for two. It's that problematic song that everybody wants to talk
Muppet
about.
Muppet Baby, It's Cold Outside?
Muppet Babies, It's Cold Outside.
Okay.
All right, Sarah.
Learning things through the power of song, like how a bill becomes a law. At 3 minutes, they're not too long, and it might make you guffaw.
Schoolhouse Rocking Around the Christmas Tree?
Yes, correct. Back to Tim.
Here in Manhattan's 15th precinct, we're solving crimes way faster than a blink. All this profanity and shameless nudity made a big splash, dear, in 1993.
So I know the show.
The show is?
The show is NYPD Blue.
All right, I'll give you 2 points for that. So see if you can piece together what comes after NYPD Blue. And I'm going to say, don't overthink it.
Yeah.
All right, let me give you another hint, just because, you know, it's
a holiday.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Yeah, there's your hint. That's your hint. Bunker, thank you very much.
Wait, was that supposed to be NYPD Blue Hawaii?
No. That's NYPD Blue Christmas. I said don't overthink it.
Don't overthink it, yeah. All right. I'll take the 2 points. Yeah,
you got 2 points. That's pretty good. All right, here is your next carol.
Right next to a college, a white man is dead. How can you make sure it won't fall on your head? Just intern with Annalise or audit her class. You'll have what it takes to get a homicide hall pass.
How to get away in a manger with murder.
There you go.
Nice.
All right, Sarah D. Bunting.
Watch World War II on BBC through folks like you and me. The Nazis are in Poland. Oh, shit, they're now in France. At least we have Sean Bean. At least we have Sean Bean. At least we have Sean Bean.
The TV show is at the end of that title.
Joy to the World at War.
Yeah, very close, very close. That is Joy to the World on Fire.
World on Fire.
Never heard of it.
All right, everybody's last carol coming at you quickly. Can I get the scores?
Oh, shit.
It's really close. Sarah's got 9. Tim's got 10. I've got 11.
All right, here we go. Woo. Tim, your next clip starts now.
If you love Aziz Ansari, then check out his Netflix show. There's comedy in NYC. Just remember that no means no.
It's Master of None. We wish you a Merry Christmaster, Master of None.
You had the right connecting word, but that is Holly Jolly Christmaster
Holly Jolly
of
Christmas,
None.
Yeah.
Mm. All right, Tara.
Yep.
A relationship guru finds out her man's a schmuck, so she moves up to Alaska to try and change her luck. The show's about her finding love, or at least some guys to fuck. Oh, hot guys and cold pines are in the Yukon. Oh, hot guys and very cold pines.
God rest you, merry gentlemen in trees.
Yes.
Nice.
Boom, 3 points. Nicely done. All right. Taking us home. Last one for Sarah.
Let's get a manicure or a pedicure, but also launder dough. We need to hide all this cash we got from selling these narcos. The mafia's killing and blood is spilling in West Florida. White guys play while black ladies pay. Hey, it's America.
All right, show's at the end there, asterisk. That's all I'll say.
Right, here comes Santa Claus.
Yes, here comes Santa Claus is correct. That's a 3 point to end the game. Tara, final score, please.
Everyone did very well. Tim and Sarah are tied with 12. I was barely ahead with 14.
All right, that means Tara.
Good job, Tara.
Tara, congratulations. Well, guys, that is it for another episode of Extra Hot Great. We took some mushrooms and went online to talk about being the Ricardos. Had to get it in there at some point before going around the dial with stops at Finding Magic Mike, MacGruber, Insecure, How to Win with John Wilson, Dead Asleep, and Law and Order SUV. We booked holidays to TV destinations, and Elon didn't book the Simpsons episode Itchy and Scratchy the Movie for the canon. We crowned winners and losers of the week, and Tara was the winner of this week's Game Time from Sully. And remember,
we're listening.
I am David T. Cole, and on behalf of Tara Ariano,
Internet Girl signing off,
Sarah D. Bunting,
we got beats,
and Tim Grierson,
she'll be adored, but only on this stage.
Thanks for listening, everybody, and we'll see you next time right here on Extra Hot Great. Happy holidays.
It ended up being a good show that night.